Welcome to Hot Yoga Radio. It's the 4th of October 2018. I'm taking my constitutional. It's a nice fine October day. I've had a concern recently about how I set up Hot Yoga Radio to discuss yoga, Buddhism, Taoism, meditation, consciousness, tantra, related topics, because there's a lot of people interested in that stuff, and I've kind of been immersed in it really for 50 years. So I have something to say which I think could be useful. I still have this neurosis that I would like to be useful in the world somehow. I think it's probably too late for me to grow out of that now, so I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing, and if that's my illusion, so be it. But the concern that I've had has been because I let myself get wrapped up in current affairs and politics and economics, and trying to get a bit of a handle of what's going on. Really since 2008, I've had this interest in money. Never had any interest in my life in getting money or making money a focus of existence. I've kind of pretty well ignored it. And always one way or the other, managed to get by. And I've never really worked my guts out for very long in horrible jobs. I have worked, but I've done things that I like doing. And generally I've engineered my life to have quite a lot of free time to study and create things and be with people and practice yoga and so forth. And the interest was really just trying to get a handle on what really had happened in 2008. And I wasn't economically naive. I had to read Adam Smith at some point in my educational career and to get acquainted with Keynes, and also I knew about Milton Friedman and so forth, and had a bit of a handle on that. I read Marx, and still found myself a little bit in the dark about the exact nature of what had gone down in 2008. I mean, I think I had a broad brushstrokes appreciation. So I kind of looked into that, really. And it is a rabbit hole. It's not my natural study abode by any means, but it's kind of fascinating, as I think anything is, if you kind of get deeply enough into it. And so it's out of that concern that I've got concerned with his current affairs. One thing I've always been interested in as well is discourse. How does discourse work? Or if you like, what's the nature of ideology? What's the nature of propaganda? Why do people believe what they believe? And in broad brushstrokes, this has come to a position that you'll hear me state throughout these podcasts, that information is power. I mean, I know Foucault said knowledge is power, but actually being able to control the flow of bits and bytes of words, of print, of television and radio broadcast material and so on is an immense power. Whether the information is true or false, you can exert power by disseminating false information, because you disseminate it well enough and are able to make it work within people, within groups of people. I mean, brainwashing is a very emotive term, but if you can brainwash the population, you can control it, and you can become in political control. Now, it strikes me that money is a very specialised form of information, and perhaps slightly simplistic truism, and it's a truism that if you've got money you can do things. If you've got enough money you can avoid paying tax. If you've got really serious amounts of money you can do more or less what you like. You can buy your own island. So, nevertheless, money is information. If you have a bank account and it says that you've got £2 million, which is, after all, just a lump of information on a ledger, you can then do things in virtue of that information being on that particular ledger. You can go and buy a big house in Wales by the sea with 12 bedrooms for that kind of money. You probably order yourself a Tesla, and you can employ people and direct their lives to some extent in virtue of being their employer. So controlling money is a big deal. Now, ostensibly governments control money, even though central banks have a lot of autonomy, and technically the Federal Reserve in America is a private company. There are some shareholders, and the Greek crisis of a couple of years ago, which is documented in Yanis Varoufakis' book Adults in the Room, indicates just how much power the European Central Bank has in conjunction with the IMF and the European Council to override any kind of political control. And Dr. Schäuble, on behalf of the Council of Europe, is reported to have said to Yanis Varoufakis, "Votes don't matter here." Because Varoufakis was protesting the fact that he was an elected member of the Greek Parliament and the Minister of Finance with a democratic mandate. But Dr. Schäuble wasn't impressed. The IMF wasn't impressed. The European Central Bank wasn't impressed. Yeah. So, immense power in the hands of money. And this means the central banks, but also the big commercial banks. Whether they're investment banks or just ordinary high street retail banks, they've got a lot of power. So knowledge is power, information is power, money is power. So it felt to me necessary, as a utopian, as somebody who thinks that the way the world is not sustainable on any front. There is a question of, well, what other way could we organise money? And I suppose that's not an unrelated question, just to, in what other way could we organise the economy? Now again, if you go back over these podcasts, you will find that I've talked about utopias and the dangers of utopian thought, but also the necessity of utopian thought. Utopias enable us to organise our thought laboratory, to do our thought experiments, as do dystopias. And my inclination is to suggest that you need to entertain both. You need to entertain dystopian and utopian possibilities. Now, I'm going over old ground here, and I think for today I want to hone in on a small discussion that I attempted to engage in on a YouTube channel in the comments. And I think it's worth mentioning because it really illustrates the map of inquiry that I've just basically outlined, which is a summary of many of the economics, politics, current affairs podcasts that I've done up till now. The gist of what went down was that a podcaster had done this polemical squib of a couple of minutes saying that conservatism, the Conservative Party in the UK, basically exists to break the poor, as the guy put it. And other political parties were formed to resist or to change the nature of the status quo. The Greens, even the Liberals to some extent, but certainly the Labour movement was set up, the Labour Party came about to resist and possibly change the status quo. Whereas the Conservative Party needn't have arisen had not this resistance come about. This is, it doesn't really need to exist, the commentator says. It doesn't really need to exist, only in as much as if the resistance is forming parties, the status quo has to form a party. And there was obviously a lot of the usual trolling and to-ing and fro-ing, but also some fairly considered comments, which is unusual on YouTube. And somebody came back with, if the Conservative Party only exists to break the poor, why did they give working men the vote in whenever it was, middle of the 19th century, and 1918, women the vote and all this stuff? Why did they do that? And why was Disraeli concerned about the split in the country into two nations, of the poor and the rich? And I suppose this was the first moment of one nation Toryism. Why did Harold Macmillan build loads of council houses in the 1950s? My riposte was really to question the notion of welfare capitalism, or if you like, capitalism with a human face. Now you'll hear Mrs. May trying this on, you know. She wants to make things better for the jam people, just about managing. And this is uttered in a condescending tone, and I mean, this was a part of the victory address, I think, when Theresa May first became Prime Minister and went out into Downing Street, stood at the lectern, and it was this pledge to make things better for, the people at the bottom. There was this proviso, you know, that you've got to be hard working. They talk about the hard working families, they were just about managing. This is a repeat of a Victorian trope around the deserving poor and the undeserving poor. You could look after the deserving poor, and Lady Muck could go down and distribute alms amongst them. But the undeserving poor, they brought it on themselves with gin and opium and laudanum, and they could fucking well rot. And we've kind of, they've resurrected this, they've softened it a bit and they've put it in modern terms, but they've resurrected it a bit. Now, how I responded to the interlocutor that was shouting up in favour of seeing Toryism as some kind of welfare Toryism or Toryism with a human face, that first of all, that the goods, like the vote, weren't given as though by, from on high, the bounty and the kindness of the heart of the ruling class, but were extracted through hard struggle, and particularly in the matter of the women's franchise. You've got to be so historically illiterate to try and gloss over that struggle. And also, I would say that the welfare capitalism grew up for a number of reasons, one of which was that the working class, in virtue of congregating in factories, being drawn into communities in factories in large numbers, were available to organise into trade unions and make demands and realise some of those demands. And without that, the ruling class would just carry on with their primary concern, which is the bottom line. Secondly, as industry developed, workers needed to be more educated and technically skilled. This means that they were actually quite an investment and a precious commodity, and therefore you looked after them. And again, it's not out the kindness of the factory owner's heart, but simply a protection of his interest. And we know that when push comes to shove, they don't mind rendering whole factories full of workers redundant if they can supply labour at a cheaper cost somewhere else. An example is in this town, there's a factory, which I think it was the biggest employer in the town, 10 years ago or 15 years ago. Making tyres. The workers were actually paid quite well, but it was shitty work. I mean, one part of the factory, the workers had to have a monthly blood test to see if they'd got leukaemia from the chemicals involved. It was nasty, not pleasant work, but very highly paid. Biggest employer in the town. But, fluctuations in the world market, and they could get cheap labour in Poland, so they shifted the whole enterprise to Poland, lock, stock and barrel. I mean, really, it's the bottom line that calls the shots. Now, some Conservatives do get pangs of conscience. They do get bits of bad conscience and try and appease it. I'm not going to say that never happens. But really, the bottom line is the bottom line. And it's even an item of corporation law that the management of a corporation has to maximise profits for the shareholders. That's its imperative. The rest is secondary. And so there's a logic there that, however, you know, that an educated worker has cost a lot of money to be brought to his technical expertise, and you look after him. Now, with the rise of automation, we can expect some kind of reversal. I think we will get a lot of jobs of very high expertise. Maybe being able to teach AIs about specialities could be a very high expertise job. But I think you can expect some jobs whereby you just kind of sit and watch, board out your school. We might see more of that kind of stuff, at least in some intermediate stage, if there aren't any black swan events that pop up and disrupt the forward march of automation and artificial intelligence. And I gave a third reason. Obviously this diatribe was only a couple of hundred words, so I'm fashing it out a bit here. But the third reason for not taking the welfare capitalism story at face value is the realisation that came about in the 1930s, after the 1929 crash, that the market wouldn't correct itself from its downward spiral into complete economic collapse and mass unemployment simply by labour pricing itself back into the market, which with classic supply-demand economic curves you would expect. And this is the much vaunted free market. And of course the reason is, destitute workers, unemployed workers, don't buy products. They've got no money to spend, so demand collapses and the economy collapses because demand collapses. Factories close, they can't sell their products. Will they lay off some workers or bring about a shorter working week? And all kinds of things of pump priming in the economy and the stuff that Franklin Delaney Roosevelt brought about in America was the only way to rescue the economy from that particular type of collapse. So welfare capitalism actually makes sense, not as some kind of kindness on the part of the ruling class, even though some of them might have pangs of conscience, but just on the pure economic necessity to keep capitalism going. There is another reason which I didn't mention, and this is the idea of the Industrial Reserve Army. They're actually a modern economy, and they are pretty dynamic modern economies, needs a reserve of people who they can pull in into employment fairly easily and quickly, and lay off fairly easily and quickly to take advantage of booms in the economy, booms in demand, where you need more productivity and actually more workers. And not letting these people starve does make sense. Otherwise, I think there's plenty of sentiment out there to say, let them starve, undeserving poor, let them starve. So the Industrial Reserve Army, actually, in modern Britain certainly, with what we call the poverty porn, which is basically the victimisation and the scapegoating of very poor people as a means of creating an internal enemy to distract the public from the real nature of the situation. So a classic ideology. So I'm saying that welfare capitalism with a human face, and all the stories that we hear around that are actually ideological covers for the real state of affairs, which is that the bottom line is king. Well, this brings up an interesting question, which plugs into the sort of fairly challenging project that I'm undertaking at the moment, which is to elucidate discourse. And I've thought about calling this series of podcasts The Producers of Discourse. Then it occurred to me that I'm interested actually in not only the producers of discourse, but the production of discourse. And not only the production and producers of discourse, but the receivers of discourse. And this is out of a concern of the rhetorical to and fro that happens on social media, Twitter, YouTube, Facebook and so on. And very widely, in fact. And the notions circulating currently, like alternative facts, post-truth, fake news, and so on. So it's a huge project with a lot of aspects, and I wanted to see if I could dig a bit deeper into it, because at the moment I can't see very much going on other than just a rhetorical, polemical to and fro. Even though some people try and dress up their contributions as having some sort of rigour or academic respectability or something like that. And my starting point will be Plato's Sophist, and I will have mentioned this in a few podcasts recently, so look out for it. There is a preliminary or a prolegomena ready. In fact, I did two, and I think I'll choose one of those and edit it and get it out. But this little aside on welfare capitalism throws up a related question. The whole matter of that rhetorical and polemical to and fro in social media, which is partly determined, though not wholly determined, by the nature of the medium. Particularly, you think of Twitter, where you've got 280 characters. I think that's where it used to be, 140. So it was like a haiku. But of course that is forcing nuanced and considered arguments into rhetorical flourishes. And if that's all we got, maybe we're stuffed. I don't know. Unless somebody can do it really well. I think some people can do it really well and can condense a lot of stimulus into a very short space. But there is a lot of just name calling. Yeah. And but even there's some kind of art gets in. You see some very, very well crafted insults. And you can't help but laugh. And I actually kind of appreciate that kind of laugh, because I mean, an insult's just an insult, isn't it? Call me a twat as much as you like. So there is an issue there, that was in my mind. Because of course on YouTube you could write, I don't know what the upper limit is, but you can write 500 words easily. Even though I doubt anybody would read it. I mean, you can spend time giving a reply like I did this morning. I mean, it didn't take me long, but I had kind of a list of sort of pretty unarguable points. But my guess is that if the guy replies, he'll just put fuck you or troll or Venezuela or commie bastard or something like that. So it's interesting, say the least. I suppose another issue around this aspect of discourse is that Twitter, Facebook and so forth are centralised companies. They are under pressure from governments to censor and to moderate, to prevent hate speech or adverts for some illegal activities and so forth. And they've got their own agendas, of course they have, because these are like huge capitalist corporations, though of a sort of a novel kind. So there's problems around that, and as I've mentioned frequently, there are geeks and nerds out there beavering away to try and produce decentralised and censorship resistant social networks. So there's a struggle there, again, which of course is a struggle over information. Anyway, enough said. Welfare capitalism is a story and an ideological story set up to cover up the reality. And the reality is that the mass of people generally have to struggle to gain goods against the interests of the ultimate owners and controllers of the means of production. In other words, the holders of power in society. This idea that they're a bunch of kind-hearted people who will look after us in a nice paternalistic fashion is bullshit. And the quicker people realise that, the better, in my opinion. Anyway, enough. Thanks for listening. Over and out. Speak soon. Lots of love. Bye bye.